Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From the Huffington Post, the Fed proposes limits on credit card penalty fees by Eileen Connolly. The Federal Reserve has proposed strict limits on penalty fees and other charges that credit card companies can slap on customers for missteps such as late payments or going over credit limits. The proposal outlines rules that would take effect on August 22nd as the third stage of credit card legislation signed by President Barack Obama last May. The majority of the new law took effect during the last week of February, and earlier provisions kicked in last August. Among the biggest changes in the Fed proposal is capping penalty fees to no more than the dollar amount of the violation. A consumer who exceeds the credit limit by $5 should not be penalized to the same degree as a consumer who exceeds the limit by $500, the proposal states. If the rule is adopted, spending $5 over the credit limit could incur no more than a $5 penalty. Currently, most major credit card companies charge over-the-limit fees that average $39, even when the amount spent beyond the limit is just a few dollars. Consumer advocates have complained this can turn a $5 coffee into one that costs $44. The law that took effect last month already requires that cardholders agree to paying fees if they are allowed to exceed their limit. The Fed proposal also would limit late payment fees to no more than the minimum required payment. So a bank would not be able to charge a $39 late payment fee, the current average for major issuers, for a late payment of $20. The same rule would apply for returned payments. The proposal also would end multiple penalty fees for a single event or transaction. So a card payment that is returned could generate a returned payment fee, but not a late payment fee as well. And it would prohibit charging fees for transactions that are declined or for accounts that are inactive. Currently, at least one bank charges a $19 inactivity fee for cards not in use in 12 months. The Fed proposal is not quite as strong in another area, rate increase reviews. The credit card law requires card issuers to review rate increases 6 months after they take effect to see if conditions change that would merit cutting the rate back down. The Fed would allow card companies to review the increases based not only on the reason the rate was hiked, like someone's credit score dropping, but on other factors like current market conditions. And the proposal would not require a company to return to the previous rate it charged before a penalty rate was imposed if a review finds a decrease is warranted. The initial reaction on the proposal was mixed. Neil Burke, author of a study for the Pew Charitable Trust Safe Credit Card Project that is quoted in the Fed proposal, praised most of the fee limits, but he questioned whether the Fed was meeting the reasonable and proportional standards set by Congress in the law in certain cases. For instance, a bank would still be able to charge a $39 late fee on a $70 payment that's past due, the average for a balance of around $2,500. That fee would equal roughly 60% of the payment. The Fed doesn't say anything about whether that's reasonable and proportional, Burke said. He also noted the Fed would not require interest rate increase reviews to consider the same factors that led to the hikes in the first place. And he pointed out there is no limit in the proposal to how much a bank could increase an interest rate. In the past 9 months, millions of cardholders saw increases that doubled or tripled their interest rates. Pew seeks a limit of a 7% hike in any given increase. The Fed will accept public comments on the proposal for a month before finalizing the rules. The full text of the rules can be found on the regulator's website at www.federalreserve.gov. And from a blog article by David Stretfeld, program will pay homeowners to sell at a loss. In an effort to end the foreclosure crisis, the Obama administration has been trying to keep defaulting homeowners in their homes. Now it will take a new approach, paying some of them to leave. The latest program will allow owners to sell for less than they owe and will give them a little cash to speed them on their way. This is one of the administration's most aggressive attempts to grapple with a problem that has defied solutions. More than 5 million households are behind on their mortgages and risk foreclosure. The government's $75 billion mortgage modification plan has helped only a small slice of them. Consumer advocates, economists, and even some banking industry representatives say much more needs to be done. For the administration, there is also the concern that millions of foreclosures could delay or even reverse the economy's tentative recovery, the last thing it wants in an election year. Taking effect on April 5th, the program could encourage hundreds of thousands of delinquent borrowers who have not been rescued by the loan modification program to shed their houses through a process known as a short sale, in which property is sold for less than the balance of the mortgage. Lenders will be compelled to accept that arrangement, forgiving the difference between the market price of the property and what they are owed. We want to streamline and standardize the short sale process to make it much easier on the borrower and much easier on the lender, said Seth Wheeler, a Treasury senior advisor. The problem is highlighted by a routine case in Phoenix. Chris Paul, a real estate agent, has a house he is trying to sell on behalf of its owner, who owes $150,000. Mr. Paul has an offer of $48,000, but the bank holding the mortgage says it wants at least $90,000. The frustrated owner is now contemplating foreclosure. To bring the various parties to the table, the homeowner, the lender that services the loan, the investor that owns the loan, the bank that owns the second mortgage on the property, the government intends to spread its cash around. Under the new program, the servicing bank, as with all modifications, will get $1,000. Another $1,000 can go toward a second loan, if there is one. And for the first time, the government would give money to the distressed homeowners themselves. They will get $1,500 in relocation assistance. Should the incentives prove successful, the short sales program could have multiple benefits. For the investment pools that own many home loans, there is the prospect of getting more money with the sale than with the foreclosure. For the borrowers, there is the likelihood of suffering less damage to credit ratings, and as part of the transaction, they will get the lender's assurance that they will not later be sued for an unpaid mortgage balance. For communities, the plan will mean fewer empty foreclosed houses waiting to be sold by the banks. By some estimates, as many as half of all foreclosed properties are ransacked by either the former owners or vandals, which depresses the value of the property further and pulls down the value of neighboring homes. If short sales are about to have their moment, it has been a long time coming. At the beginning of the foreclosure crisis, lenders shunned short sales. They were not equipped to deal with the labor-intensive process and were suspicious of it. The lender's thinking, said the economist Thomas Lawler, went like this. I lend someone $200,000 to buy a house. Then he says, look, I have someone willing to pay $150,000 for it. Otherwise, I think I'm going to default. Do I really believe the borrower can pay it back? And is $150,000 a reasonable offer for the property? Short sales are tailor-made for fraud, said Mr. Lawler, a former executive at the mortgage finance company Fannie Mae. Last year, short sales started to increase, although they remain relatively uncommon. Fannie Mae said pre-foreclosure deals on loans in its portfolio more than tripled in 2009 to 36,968. But real estate agents say many lenders still seem to disapprove of short sales. Under the new federal program, a lender will use real estate agents to determine the value of a home and thus the minimum to accept. This figure will not be shared with the owner, but if an offer comes in that is equal to or higher than this amount, the lender must take it. Mr. Paul, the Phoenix agent, was skeptical. In a perfect world, this would work, he said. But because estimates of value are inherently subjective, it won't. The banks don't want to sell at a discount. There are myriad other potential conflicts over short sales that may not be solved by the program, which was announced on November 30th, but whose details are still being fine-tuned. Many would-be short sellers have second and even third mortgages on their houses. Banks that own these loans are in a position to block any sale unless they get a piece of the deal. You have one loan, it's no sweat to get a short sale, said Howard Chase, a Miami Beach agent, who says he does around 20 short sales a month. But the second mortgage often is the obstacle. Major lenders seem to be taking a cautious approach to the new initiative. In many cases, big banks did not actually own the mortgages. They simply administer them and collect payments. J.K. Huey, a Wells Fargo vice president, said a short sale, like a loan modification, would have to meet the requirements of the investor who owns the loan. This is not an opportunity for the customer to just walk away, Ms. Huey said. If someone doesn't come to us saying, I've done everything I can, I used all my savings, I borrowed money, and by the way, I'm losing my job and moving to another city and have all the documentation, we're not going to do a short sale. But even if lenders want to treat short sales as a last resort for desperate borrowers, in reality, the standards seem to be looser. Sri Reddy, a lawyer and commercial real estate investor who lives in Miami Beach, bought a one-bedroom condominium in 2005, spent about $30,000 on improvements, and ended up owing $540,000. 3 years later, the value had fallen by 40%. Mr. Reddy wanted to get out from under his crushing monthly payments. He lost a lot of money in the crash, but was not in default. Nevertheless, his bank let him sell the place for $360,000 last summer. A short sale provides peace of mind, said Mr. Reddy, 32. If you're in foreclosure, you don't know when they're ultimately going to take the place away from you. Mr. Reddy still lives in an apartment complex where he bought the condo, but is now a renter paying about half of his old mortgage payment. Another benefit, he said, the place I'm in now is nicer and a lot bigger. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we move ahead to the second portion of the show. We've been looking at The Two Income Trap by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, and it is Why Middle Class Parents Are Going Broke. And there are some very fascinating issues and solutions to this problem. I also start with credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are really two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend that you read their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You could also listen to all of the prior shows at www.kruufm.com. Go into archives and look under Life and Debt. In the last few weeks, I've been looking at the concept of the immoral debtor and whether or not that was a myth. And we concluded that, in fact, it is a myth, that there is little evidence that morals are declining, and so much evidence that the slam the family risks are increasing in our society. In essence, people are not filing bankruptcy because they're gaming the system. It's because they actually need to, based on things out of their control. Yet, the concept of the myth of the immoral debtor still persists. We tend not to agree collectively that in most cases, financial misfortunes is simply a matter of bad luck, and that declining morals has nothing to do with the long lines in the bankruptcy courts, about 1.4 million families a year. Professor Warren says the myth survives because it provides much-needed comfort in a really challenging and, in fact, dangerous world. She says there is nothing glamorous or mysterious about the events that conspire to drive families into financial ruin. They are remarkably common, ordinary, but painful. For many people reading about this litany of disasters that we've been going over, evokes memories that are disturbing and sometimes bitter and sometimes very personal. For example, seeing a fellow employee being escorted out of the office during the latest round of company layoffs, or that moment when a call came from the emergency room at the hospital, or when we learned that there is a divorce of a friend or even in our own lives about to happen. These are real events in many, many people's lives, and they are quite painful. Plus, there's also the reality of just worrying that something is going to go wrong and losing sleep over it, reading into circumstances in our personal environment that we project out as a new disaster. An example that Professor Warren gives is with an elderly relative who is forgetful all the time now, and us thinking, well, maybe this is Alzheimer's disease and I have to help. And how am I going to do that with my job? Or what if my spouse loses his or her job because the company goes under? What are we going to do? We see that the possibility that a family, and we mean our family, faces a rapid growing chance of disaster. And that's too painful to think about, especially if there seems to be little way to avoid it. The myth of the immoral debtor nourishes the unspoken idea that families who have lost their financial footing are a tainted group, some other who are different from the rest of us. If we can believe that those in serious trouble are morally suspect, then it is easier to look away from the harsh dangers of everyday life with respect to our own life. The myth supports a comforting illusion that the rest of us are safely distanced from financial collapse, making it possible to avoid that terrifying moment of connection with someone caught in a financial disaster. We can look at many stories, personal stories, where financial disaster has taken place. Friends, relatives, neighbors, and perhaps even ourself. Some of those people wind up in bankruptcy and some of them don't, which as a bottom line may be that we think some people failed and the others hadn't in the face of the financial disaster. Well, it's true, some people have better luck when the challenges come up. If having lost a job, it may be for a short period of time and a person can get back to work. Or maybe there's some overtime pay that one can get after the challenges come through for the medical bills. But Professor Warren points out that some part of the survival has to be credited to planning. The principle that an ounce of prevention is something that helps down the road. She points out that sensible planning starts with insurance. The general prescription from any economist is that whenever a family or a business confronts the possibility of a potentially devastating danger, it's time to buy an insurance policy. Of course, there's different kinds of insurance policies we're talking about. Health insurance policy. Unfortunately, nowadays, those policies don't seem to cover everything. The deductibles are high and won't cover the accident or the surgery. There are exclusions, co-payments, caps on health insurance, and people are generally on the hook for more than they anticipated, and also that much needed services such as physical therapy or mental health treatment are scarcely covered at all. Health insurance is no guarantee that a catastrophic illness won't send a family into a financial tailspin. Professor Warren found that approximately 240,000 families with continuous medical insurance file for bankruptcy every year, at least in part because of outstanding medical bills. So that's health insurance. And if you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm talking about some prevention thoughts and plans to deal with possible financial disasters. So we're just talking about health insurance and the reality that even though people do have health insurance, a lot of them wind up in bankruptcy anyway. But look at it the other way. Without health insurance, a lot more people would be filing for bankruptcy, and it can stave off that need for some people. Ever since President Clinton, we've had promises to expand health insurance to cover all Americans. Coverage for the uninsured has remained a prominent political issue, which we're going through quite intensely these days under President Barack Obama. The bottom line, without being political about it, is that a lack of health insurance sends as many as 150,000 families to the bankruptcy courts each year. So that's a substantial problem, and it is an issue that has to be dealt with in a way that is meaningful for people. But besides health insurance, there's also another form of insurance, which, according to Professor Warren, may even be more critical for preserving families' financial health in the wake of illness. And that is disability coverage. Professor Warren asked the question, what do we mean expansion of health insurance isn't the most important initiative since the New Deal? Reducing the number of uninsured ranks high on the agenda of both major political parties, whereas disability coverage is virtually non-existent on the national agenda. But this is about the two-income trap, when families have sacrificed their own personal safety net. So disability insurance can be all that stands between them and financial ruin. Unfortunately, a majority of workers do not have any private long-term disability insurance, and only a handful of states provide coverage for their residents. Unemployment insurance offers no relief, since most states require that an individual be able to work in order to qualify for benefits. But fortunately, there is some good news. According to the professor, fixing the disability coverage problem may be easier than solving the health insurance crisis because the apparatus already exists. Virtually every worker in America has long-term disability coverage through the Social Security Disability Insurance Program. All that remains is to close the holes in SSDI safety net, many of which are big enough to drive a Mack truck through. What's the problem? SSDI disability benefits are available only to those whose condition is expected to result in death or to last at least 12 months. In addition, there is a 5-month waiting period after the onset of permanent illness. This means that anyone who is seriously ill but is expected to recover within a year is out of luck. Now, if the program were amended so that all serious illnesses were covered, even those not likely to result in death, and the waiting period were dropped to a few weeks, more like the unemployment insurance program, SSDI would save far more families from financial ruin. Disability benefits would still be reserved for those with a serious illness, but families would acquire an urgently needed safety net. In addition, under the current SSDI guidelines, the disability must be so severe that the individual is unable to perform any job anywhere in the entire country, not just the job for which the worker is trained and has spent a lifetime building skills and qualifications. This means that someone who has worked for decades as an electrician or as a surgeon, but who developed a disability that prevented him from performing those duties, would not receive a single dime if he were deemed well enough to work as, for example, a toll collector or a telemarketer. The SSDI program could be modified to provide a sliding benefit depending on the level of disability, which is the way many private disability policies work, and temporary benefits could be offered while the worker undergoes retraining. This is a great idea to help people overcome their financial disaster, or better yet, to prevent it from happening and a bankruptcy from taking place. Professor Warren suggests universal state-sponsored disability benefits, which would be ideal to fill the gap in the safety net. Now, families don't have to sit back and wait for the government to take action. We can all purchase insurance in the private market, even through our employers or on our own. Expanded coverage will not protect families against every danger. A disability policy wouldn't have saved a family that takes time off to care for other family members, but it would cover those who fall ill. This could make a very big dent in the risks facing a family. Professor Warren estimates that universal comprehensive disability coverage could help as many as 300,000 families avoid the bankruptcy courts every year, and hundreds of thousands more who are on the brink of collapse. She says that a couple can purchase a long-term care insurance policy for themselves or for their aging parents that covers both home health and nursing home care. Today, fewer than 10% of the nation's elderly have purchased private insurance to protect themselves against the risk that they will someday need long-term care, and even fewer working-age adults are covered. Once again, these policies don't provide coverage against every possible contingency, but they offer another way for a family to mitigate one of life's dangers. Now, this solution would not be free to taxpayers, and the private market for insurance is far from perfect. On the other hand, these proposals aren't all that radical either. Professor Warren has not suggested a complete overhaul of the tax structure, and she hasn't demanded that businesses cease and desist from ever closing another plant or firing another worker. She has not suggested that the United States should build a quasi-socialist safety net to rival the European model. Not that at all. All of her solutions, creating tax incentives for saving, expanding state-funded disability coverage, and encouraging families to insure themselves against an uncertain future, can be implemented within America's current blend of public and private systems without drastic changes or massive tax increases. So in conclusion, the myth of the immoral debtor, when someone like Orrin Hatch claims that the real change needed in America is for individuals to, quote, take personal responsibility for their debts, we are left to wonder exactly what he had in mind. Should people take more responsibility for losing their jobs or for having heart attack? Or maybe he means that responsible families should sell their homes and move into the street as soon as they are laid off so they run no risk of falling behind on the mortgage or owing money to the landlord. Many of the families Professor Warren studied led lives that are already thick with personal responsibility. Time lost from work to take care of an elderly parent, thousands of dollars of debt to provide medical care for loved ones. Her conclusion is that if some of these families let go of that personal responsibility, they would be in better financial shape, but we don't conclude that they would be better people. So the myth of the immoral debtor may be little more than an ugly fairy tale, but it has the power to maroon families both emotionally and financially just when they need the most support. The changes needed to increase the safety net of the middle class aren't radical, and they are not exorbitantly expensive. But they require consensus that change is essential. So long as Americans can be persuaded that families in financial trouble have only themselves to blame, then there will be no demand to change anything. In order to get on with the difficult business of making America once again safe for families to raise children, the myth of the immoral debtor must be laid to rest for good. And this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeindebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt-manageable life.